This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. Broadcasting live from the Rudy Luther Toyota Studios at AM 950, it's the Matt McNeil Show for your Monday. Good to be with you today. A jam-packed day today. Matt, Brett coming up in the 5 o'clock hour. Mary Moriarty, formerly with the Public Defender's Office, she has announced she is going to run for Hennepin County Attorney. She's going to join us to talk about that decision and how she feels that the office should go if she was put in charge there. Of course, that election comes up in 2022. That will be in the beginning of the 5 o'clock hour, but right now, it's our absolute privilege to welcome back to the show the Director of Infectious Disease Epidemiology, Prevention, and Control Division of the Minnesota Department of Health. It's Kristen Ehresmann. She's kind enough to join us today to talk about the latest status of the epidemic here in Minnesota. Director, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm happy to be with you.
It's happy to have you back. It's always nice to talk. You make me feel better. These are tough times. I appreciate your informational hug that you give us.
Well, oh, good. What would you like information on today?
Well, let's start off with obviously September had brought two things which were always going to be a concern. You had talked about it, I think, the last time you were on the air with us, and one was the state fair, and two is the return to schools. And as we have seen, both of them have led to more cases of coronavirus in the state of Minnesota. I guess maybe because we've been tracking, I know you guys have been doing some tracking there of the state fair numbers. It doesn't seem like it. I mean, we definitely have a few hundred cases that have been linked directly to the state fair, but it didn't seem as it was as bad as we were anticipating. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, yes and no, I guess. We've had about 318 cases associated with the state fair, 5 hospitalizations. So, you know, when we look at the straight numbers, it seems like, oh, that's not so bad. I think what's concerning to us is that, you know, when our teams are doing outreach and, you know, working to interview cases, we know that at any time our surveillance data are undercounts, that we never reach complete case ascertainment. But we also know that, you know, we're not able to reach about 50% of the cases at this point. And then many of the cases that we talk to are not willing to give us information about their activities. So I think it's important to keep in mind that, you know, while the absolute number doesn't seem as high as you might think, it's definitely, in our estimation, very much an undercount. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing, again, not to be negative Nelly, but, you know, we've talked about how with the Delta variant, that variant is so much more transmissible than what we saw with the wild type or even the Alpha. And so the R-naught, or the number of people that, you know, on average, a case of Delta will infect, is 7. So when you look at even that lower number than you'd expect to see for the state fair, for the second generation, that would result in, you know, 2,191 cases. And then the next time you have a generation, it goes up to over 15,000, 15,337. So it's just kind of a reminder that one, a single case is not just a single case. It kind of represents what it could spread to. And then just recognizing that we know that the cases that are reported to us and that we know about really represent an undercount of what's really out there.
And if I heard you correctly, you said the best guess is about probably only 50% of the cases you've been able to track. Is that the right number?
Right. And then of those, probably, you know, half again tell us, you know, what they actually were doing or actually are forthcoming. So, you know, you could really do some multiplication if you wanted to estimate what was really out there. So I think the important message is really, you know, those large group gatherings continue to be really risky, even if they are outside. And so that's something that people need to think about as they're, you know, contemplating the ability to do a lot more fun things now. Just think about your own risk, your vaccination status, and, you know, is that something you want to be participating in? And maybe if you do, you want to be wearing a mask.
The other major issue in September was schools, and the school system started back up. We had many school districts with mask mandates, but a lot of them didn't. Talk a little bit about it, because these numbers that we've seen coming out of the schools have been fairly disturbing to a point, as we're seeing these numbers multiply, as we're getting more and more reports, especially in schools without mask mandates, of COVID outbreaks in some of these school districts.
Right. I mean, we are really concerned about what we're seeing in the school setting. We are getting a lot of reports of cases. So, for instance, we've had, many 3,431 case reports that were submitted to us from schools over the last 7 days.
Wow.
And of course, we check that those reports, and this is what the schools, have information on. And then we check that against the laboratory data and things like that. But that's a huge number of reports. And when you look at the number of close contacts in the last 7 days, we're talking about over 44,000 close contacts that come as a result of those cases. So, we are definitely very concerned about what's happening in the school setting. And I think, we fully recognize that it's really important for kids to be able to be learning in person and be in the classroom as much as possible. And what's different this year is last year we had the safe learning plan in place. So there were mandated mitigation strategies that schools needed to follow. And what we're seeing this year is the Department of Health put out some pretty clear guidance about what schools should be doing to make the school setting as safe as possible. But many, many of them are choosing not to follow that guidance. It's a local decision. We don't have the authority at this point to mandate anything. So we have plenty of tools. I mean, we have vaccine for our adolescents, 12 to 17. Teachers obviously can all be vaccinated. Masking is what we recommend. Social distancing, making sure that sick kids stay home and that exposed kids are quarantined and that there's contact tracing. But we know that's not happening in many, many places. And so that just contributes to the spread. And we're certainly hearing from parents in those areas expressing concern.
And we
but as I said, it's a local issue. Right?
And we should also mention the danger to the staff. And I mean, we mentioned this in the way, because people always think about school as students, but we've had, numerous staff members getting sick now in these school districts as well. Is it easier to trace with a school because obviously the nature of school, if you have to call in to attendance line and, they have a way of, and I know most attendance lines are saying, hey, we're trying to track down what exactly your kid has here, so we need to, inform others. Is it been easier with the school districts to track this because of the nature of it being a school district?
Yes. I mean, that certainly helps. Although, many parents are, one of the challenges is that there are many situations in which parents are sending sick kids to school. Ugh. So, kids may be positive or may be ill and they're still sent to school. So that's part of the challenge is that, not only is it that the school needs to identify cases, but the fact that kids who are ill need to stay home. So there are many, many things at play, and it's definitely, a very, an issue that people feel very strongly about. Mm-hmm. But just to put it in perspective, when we look at the case numbers that we're seeing right now and compare them to where we were at a year ago, we are at 3 and 4 times as many cases right now as we were a year ago. And like I said, part of that is because we're not able to enforce having mitigation measures in place, and because, not everyone who can be vaccinated has chosen to do so.
I know one of the most frustrating parts about your job right now is that you're just trying to give out information, and there are a lot of people that try to turn this political. And I actually got into a bit of a discussion with a friend of mine who is like, there's no guidance. I said, what are you talking about? I mean, there's a lot of things that you guys, guidelines you're putting out. But of course, the main ones, wear masks, get vaccinated, socially distance, limit your amount, you're around people without other masks on. You know, it's, you guys have been straightforward on this. It's just, it seems like that's always the uphill battle. I mean, you have a fairly, I mean, if I can say, simplistic set of rules to follow here, and people are just choosing not to, and it's got to be frustrating.
Yeah, it is a little bit frustrating. And just to kind of clarify, I think what happened for a lot of people in the public is that, you know, when the governor had his emergency powers and when there were executive orders in place, you know, that was a mandate for people that they had to follow. And for a lot of people, they forgot that in the hundreds of years up until that point, or maybe we shouldn't use hundreds because there've probably been other times in the past, but in the many, many years up until that, the public health department, we didn't put out, you know, executive orders or mandates like that. We had guidance and people followed it. But now there's this feeling like, well, if it isn't mandated in law, you know, or there's not some special governor mandate, it must not be real or it must not be there. So yes, we, for instance, we have very clear guidance on what schools should be doing, the mitigation steps they should take, the tools and things they should have in place. So it's not that we haven't told them, but it is at this point, in the absence of emergency powers, it is a local decision. And so many of them are choosing not to follow that guidance.
The Director of Infectious Disease Epidemiology Prevention and Control Division at the Minnesota Department of Health is Chris Ayersman. She's kind enough to join us once again. Director, I've looked at some of the numbers here. You look at these counties, and indeed where you're having, I mean, it's a science, you know, lesson really, you know, and a math lesson where you have people who are getting vaccinated, you have lower rates of infection. Where you have people who are not vaccinated, you're having higher rates of infection. We've got a big problem out there, especially when you look at the central part of the state, the west central part of the state, parts of the northern part, and of course the very southern tier. There are some counties here that have a fairly astronomical amounts of infection rates.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the things to keep in mind is that, you know, certainly there's our data, but if you look at data at the national level, it all speaks to the fact that, you know, these mitigation strategies that we are promoting make a difference. So for instance, just the topic of masking in our schools, you know, CDC looked at data and you know, can say that schools without a mask requirement were three and a half times more likely to have outbreaks compared with schools that had mask requirements, you know, starting the year. There have been lots of communities, for instance, where masking was instituted, and, you know, it made a big difference in terms of transmission in those communities. So, yeah, we definitely have the information mm-hmm. that tells us what we ought to be doing and what will help prevent disease, but sometimes that is not accepted, and so we're not seeing communities act on it. And then, obviously, we see the impact with disease.
I'm with you. I the frustration I have been saying for a year now, I don't want you dead, I don't want you sick, and I don't want you bankrupt for the next 10 years with medical bills. And people say, you know, it's kind of hard when you say it so bluntly, and people said, I'm on the opposite side of you. And you're like, really? Okay, that doesn't make, you know, it's frustrating. And I know for you, it's a daily frustrating thing. There is a little bit of you know, developing good news. I mean, the booster shot has been approved. It sounds like pretty much every state's kind of doing their own thing here. Talk about that in Minnesota, because obviously elderly, once again, getting their booster shot, first line personnel, I imagine medical personnel trying to get that booster shot if they need it. But I think for a lot of people that have already been vaccinated, they're like, sure, you want me to give me a booster? I'll take it in a heartbeat. I will, for sure.
Yeah. So just to kind of summarize that, so the FDA approved booster shots, it's just for the Pfizer vaccine, though. I want to be clear that it's just for those individuals that receive the Pfizer vaccine. The good news is with Moderna, we don't see that same kind of waning, although they do have data in with the FDA. And Johnson & Johnson also has looked at booster data, so that is likely going to be coming. But FDA approved the boosters, and then the CDC, ACIP recommended boosters. So we have kind of four categories. We have people 65 and older or in long-term care, and they should get a booster. We have people 50 to 64 who have an underlying health condition. They should get a booster. And these boosters are recommended 6 months after your second dose.
Okay.
And to be clear, you don't have to get there within hours of your 6 month time frame. You know, you've got protection. You know, we're talking about a little bit of a waning in protection, not that you don't have protection at all. So just to kind of, you know, in terms of the panic level, keep it in perspective. And then the other two groups, we have 18 to 49 with underlying health conditions. That's more of a permissive recommendation. They can get a booster. They're encouraged to talk to their healthcare provider, and the same is true for those with potential for occupational exposures and greater risk due to occupation. That's also permissive, and they can get a booster. And the idea is to kind of check in and have a conversation. But yes. Boosters are now authorized for the Pfizer vaccine, and so that's exciting. Of course, we still want to make sure that those folks who haven't gotten their first doses are vaccinated, but exciting that we have boosters.
Get vaccinated, please, by all means. If you can, it's a piece of cake, and I'll tell you what, it's just the stress relief you'll get with getting vaccinated is an amazing feeling. I know that they still need to work on the FDA approval for, 5 to 12-year-olds on that one vaccine, correct?
Yes, so Pfizer has their data in to the FDA for 5 to 11-year-olds, and what we've heard is that, you know, there's been talk like, could there be an approval by the end of October or beginning of November? So we'll be waiting to see if that comes through. That will be very exciting, because then there will be an option for our elementary age kids, and so that'll make a difference. And then certainly the more people we get vaccinated throughout the whole population, the bigger difference that makes.
Indeed. Hopefully that comes soon. One final thing that actually doesn't have to do with COVID per se, but I do want to make sure I get you to mention as well. It's flu season. We generally, last year, once again, there was this big campaign saying, okay, you know, COVID's out there, but you still need to get your flu shot. Once again, people need to, as we get into the flu season here, they need to get their flu shot this fall, regardless of whether or not they think they need it or not. They need to get that, correct?
Yes, absolutely. I've already had mine. The reason that it's really important that you get your flu shot, we always recommend it. But a couple things. One is we virtually saw no influenza last year because of all the mitigation that we had in place for COVID. Those measures, masking, social distancing, you know, capacity limits, all of those things make a difference for all of our respiratory illnesses. So it really helped for flu. We don't have that this year. And we also, people didn't get exposed to flu last year, so we don't have any of that kind of natural immunity that's out there either. So it's really important that you get a flu shot and take advantage of that, because think about it, our healthcare system is really stressed with what we're seeing with COVID. And we know that when flu season hits, we stress our healthcare system out because of influenza. We don't want to have those two things happening simultaneously. So definitely get a flu shot.
I say this every time you come on, Director. I'm going to say it again. I'm very thankful personally, and I think if I can speak for a lot of other people, I think what you guys over there at the Department of Health have done has been God's work. Commissioner Malcolm, yourself, everyone there, I have been so impressed with your organization and what you have done to prevent this from being like a Texas or a Florida or some of these other states, Missouri, where they went off the cliff early this year. You guys have done a wonderful job. I know it's incredibly stressful. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. Thank you very much. I think you guys are just wonderful.
Well, thank you so much. And I'll pass that on to the team, and glad to have joined you today.
My pleasure. Director Kristen Ehresman, the Infectious Disease Epidemiology Prevention and Control Division Director, kind enough to join us today. Director, thanks once again. Hopefully we'll talk to you before too long, okay?
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Take care. Let's take a break. Come back. Unpack what she had just told us, because holy cow, she actually threw a few huge bombshells in there about some things. We'll talk about that. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. Thank you very much to the director, Kristen Ehresman, for kind enough to join us today and talk. I do actually enjoy talking to her, just because it does feel to a point like, indeed, that, you know, it's a warm hug, if you can, on information, because I think that that's the most important thing. I will say this. You know, Brett, I don't know if you heard the number here, the number of reported school cases, 3,431 so far in the last 7 days. 3,431.
That's a lot.
That's nuts. And you know, I can't tell you once again how frustrating it is to see, in some cases, people who are being paid to run out to these small town areas and scream into bullhorns about, you won't wear a diaper on my, put a diaper on my kid's face. And once again, the howler monkeys invading school board meetings and the school board abandoning science and basic math number counting to go with the howler monkeys. And, you know, it's, you know, is anyone going to take any responsibility for killing these teachers, for killing these staff members, for killing some of these kids, for killing some of their parents? Of course not. Of course not. They want all the irresponsibility, but none of the accountability. And that is the true scariness of the times we live in today, is you have people screaming about, you know, imagine someone screaming that you should not allow, you shouldn't have seatbelts, and people should be allowed to drink and drive whenever, and there shouldn't be a drinking age or a driving age. Anyone should be able to get behind the wheel of a car. And then when cars start crashing, all of a sudden that person disappears. All of a sudden that person goes to the, you know, doesn't want to talk at all about it. And the reality is that that's because they're not going to take any responsibility. They want other people to put their credentials, their reputation, their school board legal team, make them accountable. And that's the scary part. And absolutely terrifying. The, you know, 50% of they're estimating that they probably only have half the cases that really were there. And as a matter of fact, I want to be careful. The director was very clear. There's probably a heck of a lot more cases of state fair related COVID cases, but just people will call up and just say, can we trace it? And they'll say, I'm not talking to you. So it is what it is. And the other thing which she said, which I think was somewhat terrifying, is where we are at today. And reminder, the worst came last fall. The worst came last fall, even with Governor Walz and his emergency powers, because things, people started moving inside. 3 to 4 times as many cases as we had at the same point last year. So it is likely going to get far worse. But, you know, what's amazing to me is that one of the things that became clear as I was reading some stories and some analysis from across the country, the people who are buying this Trump-fed, don't trust vaccines, don't trust masks, you know, mentality, they it doesn't matter if they've got loved ones on death's door. It doesn't matter if they're already bankrupt because of hospital bills. They honestly still think they are literally willing to die to own the libs. If I go into the grave not ever having to admit the liberals were right, then I've won. And I don't know if you understand how the game is played, but if we're actually putting you in a coffin and put you in the ground or cremating you or whatever your so-called desire is, you know, you've lost. And you can sit there and probably put some, you know, quip on a gravestone, But at the end of the day, your I gotcha quip is on a gravestone. That's, you know, I don't want you sick, I don't want you dead, and I don't want you bankrupt for the rest of your life. And yet, here we are. That I'm, that's somehow a, look at him with his liberal position. Well, if it's going to be, it's going to be. Let me really quick do the Minnesota coronavirus update for today. The Minnesota Department of Health, this is just Friday, 2,803 new cases, 22 newly reported deaths, all of them this month, one person, including a 30 to 34-year-old in Hennepin County. The state's death toll is now 8,098 since the start of the pandemic. As of September 23rd, the state reported that 3,389,798 people have received at least one dose of the COVID vaccine. 3,217 people, 061, have completed the vaccine series. Through September 24th, the number of people with COVID-19 hospitalized in Minnesota were 755, down that's up from 752 on Friday. Of those hospitalized, 212 are in intensive care, 543 general hospital care. By the way, a reminder, tomorrow's numbers are really generally pretty bad. We'll get into that. The 2,803 positive results on Monday update were from 48,433 completed tests, creating a test positivity rate of 5.78%. Minnesota's test positivity rate over the past 7 days is 7.19. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. I got a lot of other stories to get into today as well. And a reminder, Mary Moriarty is going to join us. She has announced she is going to run for Hennepin County Attorney. We'll talk with her in the 5 o'clock hour. 952-946-6205. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. We're in, by the way, I should mention, we're in, of course, Ayersman, Director Ayersman is going to be spotlighted up on the SoundCloud page. I'll get that all posted out a little bit later on. Jeff is in Cambridge. He wanted to chime in on the mask issue. Welcome on in, Jeff.
You brought up a point with these people that are promoting no masks, and I've been wondering about this question. So 400,000 people died of COVID during Trump's administration.
Yes.
Studies have shown as many as 160,000 may have died just because of his poor policies. And then you have what's going on in Florida, in Texas, with anti-masking mandates and so on. Should these politicians be considered mass murderers?
Well, and Jeff, thank you very much. I appreciate the phone call on that. Here's what I'll say is that they do have some anonymity or immunity, I should say, not anonymity, immunity with their job, that they can honestly say, I was just passing policy, and they can point to people that said, hey, this person thought this policy was going to be great. Oops, sort of mentality. What I find to be interesting is when you look at the howler monkeys that are showing up to school board meetings, what they're desperately really trying to do is they're trying to get the school board to basically take responsibility, to take culpability for their demands. Because the reality is if one of those people starts just running up to people and ripping masks off their face, that person's going to get arrested, and has been. That has actually happened multiple times across the country, where psychopaths have gone in and either threatened schools or threatened individuals or have started yanking masks off kids. And that's illegal. So what they're trying to do is they're, and they know this, and the ones who are smart are not dumb enough to get into something where they themselves could get dragged into jail. So what they're trying to do is scream at school boards to get them to take responsibility for their decisions. Because the reality is that when that school board does pass it and they have a massive outbreak within that school, what are they going to say? If you go back to the people that were screaming at them, it's like, well, I was just making a suggestion. They're the ones who passed the policy. You need to go talk to them. I was just stating my opinion. And probably a lot of them at that point will say, I was always for vaccines and masks. I just was saying that people should have the choice, because they don't want to have any of the negative consequences of their position. So that's what all this is just trying to get someone else to take the responsibility for their irresponsible suggestions. And shame on any freaking school board that has been that much of a bunch of cowards to ignore science and math as a school board and allow the howler monkeys to jeopardize not only their students, but their staff. And I am getting real tired of reading about teachers and administrators at these schools dying because some idiot on the school board thought, well, those people yell a lot. I think there's still room for the debate. That guy over there is taking horse dewormer and putting it up his caboose. He sounds just as intelligent as Dr. Fauci. Yes. Yes. That. There's the two sides of the scales. And you've just said, yeah, it seems equal to me. Really? 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 Okay. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Okay. I got two cases here that, okay. Disturbing report of a body being placed into a dumpster led to a miles-long police chase involving the suspect who had a young child in the car while fleeing. Okay. Are you saying that the kid was in the car with the body? Oh, my God. The call about a man putting a body in an outdoor dumpster in an apartment complex on the 8900 block of Wentworth in Bloomington came in as a dispatch around 9:50 this morning, according to the Bloomington Police Department. Officers arrived, found a woman dead at the scene. Also at the scene, police were alerted to a vehicle leaving the apartment complex's parking lot. Other officers gave chase, tried to stop the driver on Nicollet, but they instead fled, taking officers into Minneapolis. The pursuit ended at Nicollet and 46th. Police have not revealed how the driver was stopped, though said the driver, an adult male, was taken to Hennepin County Medical Center for medical attention. In the suspect's vehicle was a one-year-old child who was given a medical exam before being released to Child Protective Services. Bloomington Police Department said there's no threat to the public, called it an active investigation. More details expected to be released this afternoon. At 1:45, 8 to 10 law enforcement vehicles remained outside the Nicollet Court Apartments in Bloomington. So, yikes. Yikes. Ugh. Then there's this other story, and the Bring Me the News has got this one. And basically only Bring Me the News has got this one. And I have got to tell you, I'm a little bit, okay. Okay. You've got to see the images for this story. I'll post it. I think I did post it a little bit earlier. The vicious assault of a 20-year-old member of the St. Cloud State swim team is preparing to undergo facial reconstructive surgery after an attacker allegedly kept punching him in the face even when he was unconscious. Chadwick Waldorp's family said he heard a female screaming for help outside his home in St. Cloud at 1:30 a.m. on September 18th. So what day would that have been? Would that have been... Today is what, the 27th? So was that last
Looking week? At Saturday.
Last Saturday. A week ago before Saturday. So 1:30 in the morning. So Friday to Saturday night, not this last weekend, but the weekend beforehand. He heard someone screaming outside of his house. He went outside, asked if everything was okay, at which point he was told by his alleged attacker to mind his business. His family says Waldorp turned around to go inside and was attacked from behind and knocked to the sidewalk, causing him to hit his head on the concrete and knock himself, he got knocked unconscious. According to his family, the man who attacked Waldorp is a St. Cloud State athlete. Citing several eyewitnesses, Waldorp's family said the attacker proceeded to punch and beat him in the head and face, even though he is out cold. He got knocked out by the sucker punch. This guy, jumps on him and like a rabid animal starts pounding on his face. The extensive injuries include a broken nose in four places, multiple facial fractures, two black eyes, superficial hemorrhaging in the eyes, broken teeth, multiple cuts, external and internal bruising of his face and head, broken tooth, punctured his mouth that required 30 stitches. The attacker and the woman who was at the scene then allegedly dragged his unconscious body around his home, trying to find a place to hide him. ultimately breaking into his house through an unlocked back door where they left him for dead, drowning in his own blood. According to the St. Cloud State University, the St. Cloud Police Department is investigating an off-campus incident between a student athlete and a student on September 18th. Okay, I want to stop. What do you mean investigating? How the hell is this guy, the alleged attacker, not in chains? Oh, does he throw a football really good? Or does he play with a hockey stick really good? Or he's really good at the dribbly? Come on! This guy's a psychopath! This guy, who does this? Seriously, this guy is a danger to everyone, for God's sakes. I mean, and don't get me wrong, we're of course going to get probably the spin mode coming out. Hey, he's a really good kid, because if you're an athlete, you get tons of leeway. And we're going to get this, he's a really good kids don't do this. They don't, first of all, make their girlfriend scream at 1:30 in the morning out in the street. Then they don't sucker punch some guy who just happened to hear his girlfriend, or I guess I can't presume it's a girlfriend, but this girl scream. Then you then don't have that person violently attack this guy, trying to clearly kill him with his bare hands, and then try to hide the body. Oh my God. How is this guy, if this was a black guy in Minneapolis, I guarantee you he would have been arrested by, 3 a.m. on September 18th. And he wouldn't be out of jail at this point. How in the hell is this guy not been arrested? Dear Lord. Oh God, I just, oh. St. Cloud State, listen to me for a sec. The university, listen to me for a sec. Forget about this guy. I don't hold it to you. Hey, you recruited him, whatever sport he's playing on, whatever, fine. You made a mistake. I'm not going to hold it against you. Throw this cat to the wolves. You need to get this guy, at the very least, you need to get this man, this violent individual, away from anyone else he could potentially do this to. Holy crud. He needs to go to jail for a long time if found guilty. But dear, how is this guy not in jail? The police department says it's not just active, it's very active. Oh, okay. Is that like double secret probation? Dude, okay, let me reread the list of wounds. Now, once again, guy hears a woman scream, comes out of his house, guy Chad, comes out of his house to see if the woman's okay. As he turns to go back in the house, he's sucker punched by this guy, knocked to the ground, knocked unconscious, and then this guy basically becomes Joe Pesci in Casino and proceeds to beat the living daylights out of this guy's head. Broken nose in 4 places, multiple facial fractures, 2 black eyes, superficial hemorrhaging in the eyes, broken teeth, multiple cuts, internal and external bruising of the face and head, broken tooth, which punctured his own mouth, which required 30 stitches. Holy cow. The student parents have also started a change.org petition calling for the arrest of the student athlete. Dear God, is there anything that just shows you the way that we treat athletes is just so screwed up in this country? This guy, my God, how is this guy not arrested? The doctor told Waldorf's family that his face looks like a jigsaw puzzle, according to a GoFundMe site that's been launched to help cover medical expenses. Someone needs to sit down with the doctor over bedside manner. Shall we just point that out? The assault has ended Waldorf's competitive swimming career and junior year of college, which will miss entirely as he recovers. This guy, the alleged assaulter, sounds like a freaking psychopath. Out of the better... Oh, don't give me this. He's a good kid. Shut up. Don't say anything. Don't come on out. Don't talk about he made a mistake. Don't talk about how the swimmer whose swimming career, he's a college swimmer whose swimming career is over because of this clown. Don't come to me and say, well, the guy apologized. What else does the guy want? He said he was really, really, really sorry for nearly murdering him in the street with his bare hands. Come on. Why are you holding a grudge? You know, he plays sports. He's got a sports career. Not like swimming. I mean, like a real sports career. Nope. This guy, it's an embarrassment. It's gotten to the point now where the media, I mean, this should have been arrested. Like I said, their arrest should have been made at 3 o'clock on the 18th, 3 in the a.m. When you knew who you clearly know who the suspect is. The university, I saw this other story. The university has suspended the athletic. He's been suspended from athletics for allegedly assaulting another student. Oh, well, thank God we've got the tough consequences out there. Yeah, hey, you can't play the sport now. You know, Matt, I understand that guy's beaten up and he's going to have his face rebuilt and all that stuff, but do you know how tough it is that he can't play his sport now? Come on! Get the guy to accept his apology and we can all move on. He's a good kid! She's just tired of this garbage. Just tired of this. St. Cloud Police Department, if this kid's not arrested by tomorrow, I am going to make it my mission that this kid is in jail, because you cannot have other human beings doing this to other human beings. This human being doing this to other human beings. You cannot have that happen in our society and have a week where this guy has been able to go around and, you know, party hardy or have fun or hang out. Or does he feel really, really bad about what happened? He'll feel really, really bad for 10 to 20. How about that? 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. One of the most no-duh observations ever this week, and I'll get into that in a second. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. Apparently on the GoFundMe page, they named the guy, and it's not clear. He's a wrestler. He's either 285 pounds or 235.
A little more Googling. It seems like 285 is what he's wrestling.
He's got to be heavyweight. Sounds like a monster. Oh, is he a good kid? Has he made a bad choice? You can think about that for 10 to 20. Holy cow. You can't have this. You can't. I mean, this guy really has some anger issues, like psychopathic anger issues. And he knows what he did was wrong, hence he tried to hide the body. I don't know what you're saying, hey, we're going to stand up. What are you doing? Just get this kid arrested, for goodness sakes. I don't care. His career as a wrestler is over. His career as a free man should be over. If the trial finds him guilty, he's still an alleged suspect. But... Well, yeah, my God, if they know who did this. This weekend, the Star Tribune posted, and this is a true story. Apparently, the accidents at the Lafayette Bridge in St. Paul, they're up fourfold. Really? I'm about to pull out my traffic hat once again from when I used to be a traffic reporter years ago. So let me get this right. You shut down that whole interchange of 94 at 52 at the Lafayette Bridge, right? Basically right on the east side of the Saints Field. You turn the ramp from eastbound 94, which, by the way, is about 200 feet before you have to make an insanely sharp right turn to go across the bridge. But that's still better than the westbound side, where you have to do a sharp 180, and then you got to do a sharp 90 into merging traffic. And you're saying you have accidents. Gee willikers. It couldn't be your really, you know, crap design, could it? But it is the Minnesota Department of Transportation. The same people who, for some reason, designed 394, the largest east-west road coming into the metro area on the west side, which is four lanes in Wayzata, three suburbs out, But on the border of Minneapolis, the largest city in the state, it's two lanes. Stupid. You've got the same MnDOT that wanted to shut down the Crosstown Commons for 6 years and reopen it with the same exact amount of lanes going in and out of it. Just a six-year paint job, I guess. Not smart. The same people that at one point had gotten rid of all the traffic lights on 169 northbound from the Minnesota River Bridge up to 494, but left the traffic lights at 494 for a while. So basically you got rid of about 4 quarter-mile backups and just replaced it with 1 3-mile backup. The same people who redesigned, and I forgot about this one, redesigned the interchange of 494 and 169, where if you're going 494 eastbound, you cannot go northbound on 169 without actually getting off on the side roads, taking frontage roads up to Valley View, and then getting onto 169, because they wanted to appease the Vikings, who had their Vikings headquarters at that point. Oh, by the way, the second they opened up that interchange, the Vikings moved over to Eagan. Yeah, that MnDOT. I get it. Some person comes on out and says, hey, there's a Swedish guy here who says we have to keep the integrity. Don't get me wrong. I'm all about historical integrity. But I'm also understanding that you can't you have a large city here. You've got to work around the parameters that you've got, and you need to have effective transportation, which isn't requiring 6 lanes going down to a single lane on an exit ramp and then acting like, did we do a good job when there's a massive backup and tons of accidents? I am not a structural engineer. I do not do road construction. I don't do any of that. And if I can look at what you guys have done and say, I won't do that, it tells me a lot about your design flaws in the city of Minneapolis-St. Paul. So, hey, guess what? There's a ton of accidents there. We were put a bunch of hairpin right turns. Good luck, kids. Hope you survive. Hour two of the show is up next. Yes, who could have ever suspected that if you have to come into a sharp 90-degree right turn on the Lafayette Bridge, 65 miles an hour in 200 feet, you might actually have an accident or two. Have you almost... that is one of the worst intersections in the entire city.
You jogged my memory, unfortunately, of 169 and 494 there.
Oh, gosh.
That was bad. I've over that for years and years and backing up for miles and miles.
Do you remember the old right turn you had to do? It was a right turn. 35W northbound at the downtown Minneapolis. You had to, it literally was just a straight right turn right into the Portland Tunnel.
I remember when I went to Augsburg when I had to come up from 35W. I'd have to merge on to 94 in the left lane, then in like less than a mile, move 4 lanes to the right to exit over on Cedar Riverside.
Coming to this radio station, if you come here 169 southbound, you got to jump on the crosstown, and within about 40 feet, you got to get from the right lane to the left lane to get to the 212 exit over, heading on down towards the palatial broadcasting.
Oh, and good luck if you got a semi in front of you.
Oh, yeah. I can tell you right now that center median it can handle a car. It can. Oh, yeah. Thank you, Toyota Sienna. not an actual thing. Okay. Big news today. If you had not heard, Mary Moriarty, the Hennepin County public defender for 31 years, also chief public defender as well, Hennepin County defender, public defender, and of course, commentator. Many people followed her Twitter account during the Derek Chauvin trial. She has made the decision to run for the Hennepin County Attorney's Office next year. She's kind enough to join us today to talk about this decision and her vision for the office. Mary, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Thank you for inviting me to be with you today.
My pleasure. I know that this has been a decision that, you know, a lot of people kind of have been saying in social media, I hope you run. Is that kind of where it came from? Is that a lot of people just coming up saying, yeah, you need to be in that office at this point?
You know, it actually started when I wasn't reappointed as chief public defender, and people would say to me, so I'm really sorry about what happened to you. Would you run for county attorney? Kind of in the same sentence. And I, at that point, really had to put a lot of thought into it. It's a really big decision to make. It's a really, really important office. And so what I did was to spend July, August, and September talking to people throughout the county, asking them what they wanted to see in the next county attorney. And through those conversations where I really listened to what people wanted and thought about how I could contribute, that's really where I ended up making the decision that this was the best choice for me right now in my life.
You brought up when they did not bring you back as a public defender there. A lot of people looked at you and just sort of said, well, you seem to be the face of change, of reform, of progress. And it almost seemed like your dismissal, you getting turned away from that office was like, no, we're going to keep the things in place as it was. I mean, at least that's from the public perception. And I remember talking about it back then. It's like, okay, this is the person that we should be talking about where we should be going because things need to change. And it just, that was ugly to a point. It was very ugly.
It was, especially living through it. And I think you've hit the nail on the head. I was told by the head of public safety in Hennepin County that I was to consider myself part of a family and that I shouldn't be talking publicly about any problems in the family. And by family, he meant the Hennepin County prosecutor and judges. And, you know, I don't think anybody in Hennepin County wants the chief public defender to be aligned with the prosecutor and judges as opposed to the community and her clients. I don't think anybody in Hennepin County thinks that the county attorney should be aligned with some kind of family in the county. And that is really part of the problem. And it's another reason why I want to run. And that is to bring trust to this office. And the only way I can see doing that is by building relationships, being extremely transparent about what's going on, what the policies are, why a decision is made or it's not made, and being accessible to the community by being in the community and listening.
Mary Moriarty is joining us right now. She's made the decision to run for the Hennepin County Attorney's Office next year. I think it's important when we're talking about this. Obviously, we're electing individuals. Why don't you give us a little bit? I know we obviously a long career with the Hennepin County Public Defender's Office. Why don't you talk a little bit about your background? Who exactly is Mary Moriarty?
Oh, yes. I grew up in New Ulm, which is in southern Minnesota. My father was a part-time public defender, and so I'm going to date myself here when I say that my dad had cassette tapes of trial practice, like hearsay and the Ten Commandments of cross-examination. And as a child, we used to do errands in New Ulm, and I would listen to the Ten Commandments on cross-examination. So while I didn't exactly want to go to law school when I was a child, I think I must have been destined to do that as a child. When I went to law school, I wanted to be a public defender. I came to the office pretty much right out of law school, although I did a short stint as a clerk with Judge Kevin Burke. And I did trial work. So in other words, I was a trial lawyer for 22 years and I tried murders and misdemeanors and pretty much everything in between. So that gave me a really good opportunity to understand how prosecutors worked, how judges worked, how the system worked, and what the problems were with it. As in my 6 years as chief public defender, I was privileged to be able to lead an office of over 120 lawyers. And so I've had experience in management, which I think is really important. I enjoyed my job very much, but that was not something I was able to do anymore. And so I decided, you know, I could be retired and I could be angry about what happened, or I could think about how I could best contribute. And so that's why I decided to run.
You bring up the public defender element of your career. It's interesting if you go across the country where reform is happening in some of these county attorney's offices in some of these larger cities, where it's happening is there is a recurring theme of public defenders running for the office and taking over the office. And one I remember, I think it was in Los Angeles, he was saying that, you know, being a public defender gives you the perspective that you need to have to run this office, because there are too many times that people don't understand both sides of that of the case. And that really is where you need to be if you are going to be a
in the county attorney, because you have to understand the every element of it. And if you've already come on in with, you know, with or without that level of experience, or with predetermined mentalities towards the people who are going to be the defendants, it that doesn't work.
No, in fact, I think it's a huge advantage for me, having come from the perspective of a public defender. If you are in prosecution, sometimes it's really hard to think outside of that box, and you perhaps tend to think about the way you've always done things. I, as a public defender, understood and understand the trauma that our clients experience, but I also understand the trauma that people who are harmed experience. And I've spent a lot of time talking to people who were harmed about how they feel about the county attorney's office to get a sense of where I could do much better. And I've heard a lot about how people who are victims, who are harmed, want something different moving forward. And so that's something I can bring. But I do think it's a great perspective for me coming in from the outside, but kind of from the inside too, because I can think way outside the box. And I've been the student of criminal system reform for many, many years. And so I've studied what's been going on across the country. And I'm certainly aware of Chesa Boudin from San Francisco. Interestingly, the progressive prosecutor in LA used to be a police officer. Wow. And he was unhappy with what they were doing.
You're right.
And seeing that it didn't work as a police officer. And so he has come in with some of the same progressive policies that you've seen from Chesa, the former public defender in San Francisco.
That's right. Thank you for correcting me on that. It was San Francisco on that. I wanted to talk about, you mentioned reform, and there are a lot of really smart ideas that are being put out there. You know, I know your campaign is in relatively its infancy at this point. You just announced this morning. Mm-hmm. But what are some of the reform options that you would like to see placed into the Hennepin County Attorney's Office?
Well, I think it's important to take a step back and think about how what we've been doing isn't working. I mean, I think that's pretty clear. And I think post George Floyd, people are willing to, even if it doesn't personally impact them, understand that things aren't working for fellow members of the community, particularly people of color. And so I want to take a look at racial disparities. One thing that I would look at are all the decision points in the prosecutor's office, who they charge, who they don't charge, what they charge them with, do they ask for bail, what the resolution is, because I'm pretty sure there are going to be racial disparities there, not because anybody's a bad person, but because we all perpetuate racial disparities because we have unconscious bias. And so the key is to own that. And to roll up your sleeves and figure out what to do about it. And that should be in concert with members of the community and organizations who have been thinking about these issues for quite some time. I also think we need to approach substance abuse disorder from a harm reduction perspective. It does not work to send people who are struggling with addiction to prison. It doesn't help them get through that illness and disease. I think we need to treat youth or juveniles as kids because they are kids, and we know their brains don't develop until 25, 26. And there's lots of research on that. And so what I would emphasize is that there's plenty of research on what we could be doing better, and there's plenty of research on the fact that what we are doing isn't working. The other thing I should point out to people is I know police accountability is a big thing right now. And I think people focus on whether the prosecutor charges or does not charge a police officer. But a huge area that I would take a look or not take a look at, I would do, is that it's really public defenders and prosecutors that see most of the body cam, or they're the people who see more of it than anybody else. And so as prosecutor, you have to look at that body cam and see, are there constitutional violations, but also policy violations during the everyday interactions with the community? And if there are, be pointing these out to the police officer and leadership of the police if necessary. Because in that way, the Hennepin County Attorney can play a big role in helping police hold people accountable. They're people accountable. you know, when you look at the arbitration decisions, you can sometimes see that they get flipped because there hasn't been documentation of prior problems. And that's one of the things that the county attorney's office should be doing, is you see, you know, someone with their knee in somebody's neck consistently, you're showing that to the police chief and saying, hey, you've got to do something about this. And in that way, the prosecutor can help police chiefs hold people accountable. I believe that even police chiefs who are progressive and really want reform really can't do that alone, that everybody in the system, especially the county attorney, because they're seeing that body cam, have to play a big role there.
Since you brought it up, I will ask, I mean, obviously this fall there's going to be ballot. Your race is next year. But this fall, mm-hmm. there's a big ballot question here on what is going to happen with the Minneapolis Police Department. If nothing does change, if we still have the Minneapolis police after this November's election, do you feel as if you'll be able to make these reforms with that police union there? Because it seems, as to me at least, that's pretty much where the logjam happens, is the police union, the amount of power they have with that contract, it prevents real reform from ever taking place.
I think that there can be reform, and here's why. The public defender's office was unionized. The prosecutor's office is unionized. I'm familiar with progressive discipline, and I understand it takes hard work and documentation. And I think perhaps what's been lacking thus far is the documentation that body cam can provide. You know, so for instance, if we're seeing behavior or patterns of behavior from particular police officers, and we are making sure that leadership of police have that so they can be documenting it, it is possible to remove police officers who are not following policy or procedure, but you have to document it. And to document it, you have to know about it. I think policing is one of those professions where it can sometimes be hard for leadership to really see what's actually happening. And it's really those day-to-day interactions with community members that we're hearing a lot about. We know how many in the community feel that they're being treated, but it is the people who are looking at the body cam that can actually see that and be making sure that people know about it, people in the proper position, so that they can document it. The other thing is that prosecutors' offices throughout the country are now creating lists of police officers that they will not call as witnesses in cases because of they have lied under oath or they have engaged in patterns of abuse. And so even if for some reason a police chief decides that they can't or don't want to remove a particular person, they're not going to testify at trial. I mean, that is the power of the prosecutor. They choose whether to charge or not charge. Mm-hmm. They can choose whether to call a police officer or not. So there are some really powerful levers of reform that the county attorney's office could use and that I would use.
I'm going to have one final question for you, and I'll set this up myself here. When Mike Freeman came on out with the Jamal Clark decision not to charge the officers, I was on this radio show, and I actually wrote a blog piece where I poked. I'm not a public defender. I'm not a lawyer. I've not. Mm-hmm. But I was able to punch some major semi-sized holes in his arguments on why he wasn't charging them. When you had the George Floyd murder, you had the attorney general yanking the case away from Freeman and taking control of that case. And then you have now the story of Stallings and what happened 4 days after George Floyd's death and the shooting there, and the realization that there was not only a tremendous amount of lies that happened by the police force that happened in the Stallings case, but a decision that with even with the body cam footage, the decision to go to trial with this is mind-numbing. Whoever takes over the Hennepin County Attorney's Office is going to have to deal with an office whose image is really tarnished at this point, because I get the impression, especially in the city of Minneapolis, there's not a lot of people that have faith that the county attorney's office is looking out for the betterment of the people, just basically kind of towing the line of the police. Talk a little bit about that and how you would address that.
I think that's absolutely true. And it's been very clear when people have demanded that cases be removed from the county attorney's office. And that's why I talk about building trust in the community. When I look at the Stallings case, what happened to him was absolutely reprehensible. There's no reason, no excuse that he would ever have been charged with anything. And it's just by luck that the jury acquitted him. And now that we can all see the body cam, we can see, especially the body cam that came out today or yesterday, we can all see what the prosecutor had. And we can see that Mr. Stallings threw his gun, gave himself up, and is lying there on the ground for a substantial period of time when an officer comes up and starts kicking him in the head and punching him, ultimately breaking his eye socket. If anybody else did that, that would be a felony assault. And as I look at that case, there's certainly no reason, no argument that he was using lawful force. And so my question is, why was Mr. Stallings charged? The question should have been, should that officer have been charged with felony assault on Mr. Stallings? But you're right, the public right now has no trust in that office as a whole. And that's something that I would work very hard to restore. Now, part of that is being in the community and listening to what they have to say. But part of it is also a management challenge. What I would do is I would have to make sure that people in the office understand that the county attorney's office is there to do the right thing, not to win. Prosecutors' offices are not supposed to be about winning. They are supposed to be about doing the right thing for the people of Hennepin County. And so there's a culture shift that needs to change there. And I'm not saying that all prosecutors there are like that, but that is the culture, and that needs to change. I would need to be very specific about policies and my expectations. I would need to do whatever training is required. And then there has to be the accountability piece. People need to be willing to administer those policies on a trial level, or what I'm saying to the public is meaningless. And so that's one thing I would do, is to make sure that my policies are very clear, and that there's my expectations are clear of people, and that there's accountability for that. Mm-hmm. And that, in combination with being in community and being transparent about what we're doing and why we're doing it, is really important. One of the things that I think people, and I struggle with too, is you don't sometimes, let's use Dalal Eid as an example. We know that the Dakota County attorney just decided relatively recently not to charge the officer in that case. But it was the Dakota County attorney. And in my opinion, nobody elected the Dakota County attorney to make decisions on behalf of the people of Hennepin County. So that decision should have been made by the Hennepin County attorney or the attorney general. But one of the problems I see, and you may have seen this too when you were listening to Jamar Clark's press conference, is that the prosecutors don't always talk about what the law is and what might need to change. For instance, in Dalal Eid, we're told that there's body cam where Mr. Eid shot at the police officers. And what prosecutors need to do is talk about the fact that right now the law says you have to look at that exact moment when police use deadly force and decide whether it was appropriate. You don't get to look at whether the officers escalated the situation to get to that point, such as what happened with Jamar Clark. And what you also don't hear prosecutors say is, let's look at the policy that was used here, because there's a problem with that. When you look at Dalal Eid or Winston Smith, for that matter, they used what's called vehicle containment as a strategy. And so you can see it in the pictures of the Smith case, because that happened on the top floor of a parking ramp. But you see him boxed in, and you see that they did that to Dalal Eid. I think that invokes a fight or flight response. And what we're seeing is, in Mr. Eid's case, a tragic decision that ends in the loss of his life. So let's talk about that policy, which is not about de-escalation. It's about escalation. And let's say we need to change that policy. We need to make it clear that police departments should be adopting a policy where they keep a distance, keep themselves safe, but give the person a chance to breathe in the hopes that everybody goes home safe at night. So I think that transparency and that education of the public about what's going on and where they can advocate is really, really critical in building trust.
Amen. I'm glad you're running. I am glad you're running.
Thank you.
Do you have a web page yet that's set up?
Yes. Mary for Hennepin.
Mary for Hennepin. Is it F-O-R? Yes. It's a F-O-R Hennepin?
F-O-R.
You can tell.
If people want to donate or volunteer, it's all right there. We did think a little bit about the four number, but no, it's F-O-R.
You can tell I've talked a lot about campaign websites in the past.
Yes.
Mary for F-O-R Hennepin. I'll get that link out a little bit later on. We'll spotlight this interview as well. Mary, congratulations on the decision. We look forward to the campaign coming up in the next year. And thank you very much for the time this afternoon.
Thank you.
Mary Moriarty, kind enough to join us to talk about her campaign to be the Hennepin County Attorney. 952-946-6205. A lot to unpack there as well. We'll come on back after the break. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Mary Moriarty, wow, what a great interview. I'll try to get the, considering the Hennepin County Attorney is, and Freeman's just has driven that office into the freaking ground. Let's just be honest about it. Yeah, I will, I'm probably interview all anyone who else who does put their name into the hat to that race here. Brett, apparently, though, you have some breaking news that we need to talk about, right?
This one comes to us from the ABC affiliate in Birmingham, Alabama. Here's the headline, just to tell you all you need to know.
All right.
Alabama man found sleeping in press box amid pile of chicken fingers, chips, candy, and meth.
And meth, you say?
And meth,
that
yes.
is a progressive snack shack that they've got there. It's, I'll have the chicken fingers and, hey, meth. I'll have some of the meth. Why not?
You want a few more paragraphs
of it? Which press box are we talking
about?
This
is a local high school.
High school press box. Was it the fighting meth heads?
He breaks into a local press box, and by the sounds of it, he fires up the concession stand and just goes to town with the chicken fingers and candy.
Well, when you're taking meth, you're going to have some time on your hands. So, you know, that's, you're working. Okay, please continue.
Yeah, here we go. The Pleasant Grove Department of Public Safety says 37-year-old Matthew Williamson was charged September 17th with unlawful breaking and entering a vehicle and theft of property. He was transported to the Jefferson County Jail. According to a news release, less than 2 hours after Williamson made bond, he stole a car in Hueytown and hit it in Pleasant Grove. On September 22nd, there was a report of an unknown person breaking into the concession stand at the Pleasant Grove High School Athletic Complex. And the next morning, Williamson was found sleeping in the press box.
You had the report that the guy was there, and you just did the, I guess I'll wait till morning to go check that out. Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll let him have his good time.
Crime alert in Pleasant, was it Pleasant Valley?
Pleasant Grove.
Oh, where we give the burglars a head start. Okay, so
yeah, the next morning he was found sleeping in the press box among a pile of chicken fingers, chips, candy, and meth. Williamson admitted to the crimes and was transported to the.
Did he admit?
It wasn't me.
Let's see if we can figure out who did this one. How about the guy in the pile of chicken wings with the meth? I'm going to put my money he did it.
Yeah, he was transported to the jail, held on $32,000 bond, but I just love he breaks into the stadium and decides to fire up the concession stand and then...
So wait a minute here. They took a guy who smelled like chicken wings, chips, candy, and meth, who'd been lying in a pile of that, and they put him in a jail cell. I'm hoping it wasn't communal because I would be walking by and people would be licking the guy. Ah, you smell delicious.
You happen to find the photo. He looks exactly like you would picture him to look like.
He looks Pierce Brosnan?
I just love that he chooses to break into a high school.
Oh, God.
You're at least not even going to a community college or
Division I school. No Division III schools around there, you know. No Votex, nothing like that. No, it's going to be a high school. It's a nice high school, man. That's a concession stand. Sounds like they got some good deals down there.
He's able to fire up the chicken fingers and just steal a bunch of candy. And
it's Alabama. You already know. They just put them back in the fridge. We'll just serve them on Friday. Not the meth. The meth we always leave available constantly. Oh, he had. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Quite a party that Friday night.
Why didn't you tell me this story before Mary Moriarty? Because then I could have said, Mary, what's your progress? How would you charge this case? I think this is, I know it's Alabama and all, and it's a Pleasant Grove, but, you know, it's, God, can you imagine? Now I'm going back into every sports play-by-play guy I've ever worked with in my entire career. And the thought of every one of them walking into the press box to do the Friday night football game and the stench that would be. Whoa! I'm guessing Pierce Brosnan here, probably from the looks of the photo, had an O'Dare before the chicken fingers and meth incident.
Yeah, I think so.
That's really Old Spice, by the way. 11 herbs and spices, you say. Did he just all of a sudden just give up on the eating and just started, you know, rubbing them all over himself?
Yeah, and then a pile of all of this stuff, chips, candy, meth, and Chingachgook.
They actually got to the description of a pile. Wow. Sir, I'm going to just say you might have a problem.
That press box is going to stink.
Okay. God. Why is no one in the stands in front of the press box? There's going to be like a big area where no one wants to sit there. Oh, God, it'll be like the car BO story from the Seinfeld. No one wants it anymore. Oh, God. Look for the deals in the snack shack because they got to get rid of merchandise. It's got to go. 952-946-6205. And where did they find the dipping sauce, you say? Never mind. Oh. No. Stop. All right. I want to say real quick, because I'm going to piggyback on something Mary Moriarty discussed in regards to the reformer story, which has more on the body cam footage from the Stallings case. I'll get to that in a second. But I did once again go out to, as you know, I'm trying to find a new church because the Catholic bishops, when they basically said, we're going to basically make, you know, it a political litmus test to get communion in regards to Joe Biden, I said, I've had enough of you clowns. And they keep saying, it wasn't political. Every one of those bishops was running out there saying, Joe Biden's got my congregation all in a tizzy. Yeah, wait, the same congregation? Did they ever get into a tizzy when Donald Trump violated the Gospel of Matthew? Constantly. Where is Mexico's going to build the border wall in the welcome in strangers from strange lands passage? I don't see it in there. I don't see that. No, you guys, it's you decided to go political. The heck with you. I loved my church. I like the Pope, but it's the people in between that I can't stand. And so I've walked away from the Catholic Church. My whole family has. We were out at the Union Congregation, United Church of Christ, once again over in St. Louis Park. And I heard the story, and I want to make sure I give you know, I want to try to give these guys a hand. They had a trailer out there. A longtime fan of this radio station was Joe, and she passed away a few years back. And she did a lot for the community. She was absolutely a stellar human being, an absolute stellar human being. And she was part of the group there that was trying to get, you know, food, clothing, anything, funds to help out the needy. And that was what their trailer was. And the trailer got stolen. And so they need some help. So if you can go to unionslp.com, that's unionslp.com, call them up, find a way you can make a donation. let's help get that trailer back, because, you know, it's yeah, crime is horrible and stuff, and things are bad. But that was a lot of help to a lot of other people. And a lot of very nice people there are trying to help out the neediest in our society. And let's try to help them back out again. So unionslp.com, unionslp.com, 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Let's get into the reformer story. Now, once again, we want to go back to this entire story. I want to give... is it Dina Winter over there has done the exceptional work on this, I believe.
Yeah,
it is.
That's her, yeah.
Dina Winter at The Reformer. This has been as good of journalism as I've seen in decades. It is fantastic. Back on September 1st, they broke the story of the Stallings case, where the St. Paul man was basically shot at Mr. Stallings, and from an unmarked car, unannounced. They did not tell him he was police. They did not. It was an unmarked car. They just started firing rounds, hit the guy in the chest. He returned fire because he thought he was about to be killed. And then when they identified themselves as police, he put his weapon down. They proceeded to beat him senseless in the street. And then they still charged him with the crime. And it was only when, I think it was December of last year, when they had the pretrial court hearings and they were trying to determine what was going on. Not only did you see the footage, the body cam footage, which clearly showed Stallings was innocent of everything these guys had accused him of, but then you find out some cops like hurting citizens of Minneapolis, that this was basically a coordinated, they wanted to go on out there and attack the city of Minneapolis, this after George Floyd. And even one of their lieutenants apparently was making the argument that he didn't like the fact that the white supremacists were getting a bad rap, and so wanted to get other people arrested to kind of help the white supremacist image. I mean, I'm kind of paraphrasing quite a bit there, but you get the point. This is an ugly case, and well, now the body cam footage is starting to get released. It just gets uglier and uglier, and there really has to. Mike Freeman needs to be dragged out of his damn office and explain to people, if you saw this body cam footage, what the hell was your office filing charges against Stallings for? Unless it was just blind allegiance to the Minneapolis police. No wonder whoever does take over this office is going to have a nightmare to deal with. Going to the reformer story. They obtained body camera and other videos from an incident in which St. Paul man shot at a Minneapolis SWAT team after they fired rubber bullets at him from an unmarked van. The incident, which took place 5 days after George Floyd's murder, rocked the city. After the SWAT team fired a 40-millimeter round at Stallings and his friends without warning from the side of a darkened cargo van crawling along Lake Street and 14th, Jaleel Stallings, 29, fired three shots while taking cover near his pickup. After a July Hennepin County jury trial, Stallings was acquitted of all eight charges after testifying that he acted in self-defense, not knowing the men shooting were cops. He then immediately surrendered once he realized they were law enforcement. While he lay face down on the pavement, unarmed police, police beat him until his eye socket was fractured. After some legal wrangling, the Hennepin County Attorney's Office agreed to let Stallings' attorney Eric Rice disseminate the body cam videos and other evidence produced at the trial. A 2016 standing order prohibits the disclosure of body cam evidence unless the prosecutor agrees to the release. Rice fought to release the evidence that led to Stallings' acquittal, noting just one of the charges had a mandatory minimum sentence of 10 years. One of the charges. They were going to put him in for 10 years for basically defending himself. Stallings, an Army veteran, said before the incident, a group of people had warned Stallings that people were shooting out of a truck, so he armed himself with his legal pistol. He was legal. Notice the NRA is not talking about this case at all. The newly released videos show how quickly the incident unfolded. After someone ran by yelling, "They're shooting, they're shooting," Stallings and his friend tried to take cover. Stallings was struck in the chest while trying to get into his pickup truck. He fired back immediately. He didn't do anything wrong at all. As the van approached 14th Avenue, Sergeant Andrew Patel told the SWAT team there was a group in the parking lot to the north. They began firing at several people standing near Stallings' pickup. The officers yelled, "Shots fired, shots fired," jumped out of the van. Stallings said that's when he realized there were cops. He dropped flat to the ground, discarded his pistol, put his hands onto his sides. A parking lot surveillance video shows the beating he took for it, with Minneapolis police officer Justin Stenson immediately pouncing on Stallings, kicking and punching him in the head and neck. Body cam video shows Stallings repeatedly tried to surrender, saying, "Listen, listen, sir, I'm trying to," as Stenson and Battelle beat him for 30 seconds. Stenson wrote in his report that he struck Stallings to gain control of him, even though he was flat on the ground, and claimed Stallings wasn't complying. He's a lying sack of crap, and he should be charged with a crime. Period. Dear Lord, how many times did this guy lie about this while he was beating an innocent man in the street? In his written report, Battelle didn't say his team fired any rounds at Stallings before fired at the van, writing only that he heard shots fired from the rear of the pickup and saw muzzle flashes from that area. "Oh, we were scared for our lives!" Oh, you don't think Stallings was scared for his life? Here comes a bunch of freaking clowns in an unmarked car opening fire on him unprovoked. Yeah, he was scared, and he fired back. Oh, but let's hear about how your little boo-boo kitty feelings were hurt, police officers in Minneapolis. You're punks. You're just punks. Gang members without colors. You do have a color. But it's just disgusting that this is just absolutely an embarrassment that this happened. And how in the world did you charge Stallings? How in the world have you not charged these officers yet? Oh, did you give them commendations? Did you give them medals? Even though you had all this evidence? Dear Lord. The newly released body cam video excerpt show the officers riding in the van down Lake Street, which was covered in anti-police graffiti and eerily empty. In this written report, Stenson described Lake Street as a complete mess and looked like the scene out of a movie. He said every other store was looted and had fire damage from the night before. Before coming upon Stallings, the video shows the SWAT team fired 40-millimeter rounds at civilians without warning, then yelled at them to go home. Jeez. This is quality police work, right, Mike Freeman? Quality police work in your mind, right? Great. That alarmed one of those civilians at 15th Avenue and prompted him to run past the parking lot near Stallings' group yelling they're shooting. Earlier that night, Battelle had ordered the unit to drive down Lake Street. You see a group, call it out. Okay, great. Blank them up. Gas them. Blank them up. Quality police work. Rice also released the audio recording of the police questioning of Stallings at the hospitals afterwards. He was treated for the fractured eye socket, numerous scrapes and bruises. When asked if he would give a statement, Stallings asked, "Is everyone okay?" The officer replied, "Depends on what you consider to be okay. No one was mortally wounded." Stallings says he wanted to make sure everyone was okay. "That's what I was really concerned about," he said, before asking to speak with a lawyer. "They were concerned about what happened. I appreciate that." But the criminal complaint said that during the questioning, Stallings asked if anyone had been killed. And after being told no, he said he wanted to speak with a lawyer. The statement was ended. He said nothing about him asking if the police were okay. So once again, more lies from the police. After reviewing the evidence of the case, Rice said he asked the prosecutor to either dismiss the charges or offer a substantially mitigated resolution based on the officer's conduct. The prosecutor declined. Before the trial, the prosecutor offered a plea agreement with Stallings, would plead guilty to both attempted murder counts and get a 153-month prison sentence. He declined. I mean, everyone, these officers, their leaders, everyone that saw this video, body cam video, and said Stallings need to be charged, everyone in Mike Freeman's office, anyone that prosecuted this case, you all need to be fired. You all need to be charged. I mean, you're trying to destroy this man's life. You knew he was innocent. And don't give me, Freeman and your entire goddamn office, do not give me that line of, "We were just what," you knew he was innocent. You knew he hadn't done any of the crimes that you were accusing him of. You knew it, and you still prosecuted him. Which leads me to ask the question, how many other times have you done this, Mike? How many other times have you had evidence that the person that you were taking to trial, that you were trying to give a plea offer to, was innocent of the crimes that you had accused them of doing, and you still prosecuted them, or you plea dealed them into going into jail when they had done nothing wrong? How many other times, Mike? I think the public needs to know. Your office is broken, is just as broken as every damn other thing here. And frankly, the fact that these officers still have not been charged with a crime is an embarrassment. I mean, anyone associated with what the hell happened in this incident needs to be fired, or at the very least get a medical mental examination to see if they're mentally fit to be within society. Everyone. But you still have to answer the question, Mike, how the hell did you prosecute this crime when you knew there was no crime there? There was no there. That's not just me saying it. That's the jury saying it. The jury said, oh, there's no crime here. You're horrible people. You're horrible, horrible people. You tried to plead this guy? You tried to get this guy to take a sweetheart deal of 153 months in prison, and you knew he hadn't done any damn thing wrong. How in the hell are any of you still employed? You all should be in jail. You all should be in jail. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Watch out for the guy. Smells like chicken fingers and meth. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. How many other cases just like that has that office prosecuted? Where they knew the individual wasn't guilty of the crimes they were charging them with, but they still charge him and then try to, hey, we'll offer you 153 months in jail if you plead guilty before the trial. Good on Stallings. Good on Stallings. I'm to a point terrified of an investigation into that office to determine how many cases like this they've actually prosecuted through. To find out that there might be any one individual in jail who they knew was innocent of the crimes. I am terrified to find out exactly how many that number really is, though. I am terrified to find out. It could be zero. Could be 12. Could be 15. We don't know. But the fact that they were so intent on going through with this with Stallings, that tells you, my guess is going to be that wasn't the first time that happened. Not at all. Speaking of crimes, possible crimes, just days after South Dakota's agency moved to deny her daughter's application to become a certified real estate appraiser, Governor Kristi Noem summoned her to her office, the state employee who ran the agency, the woman's direct supervisor, and the state labor secretary. Uh-oh. Noem's daughter attended too. You hurt my little princess. Was it take your daughter to work day? Well, that's one way to do it, I guess. Cassidy Peters, then 26, ultimately attained certification in November 2020, 4 months after the meeting at her mother's office. A week after that, the labor secretary called the agency head Sherry Bren to demand her retirement, according to an age discrimination complaint Bren filed against the department. Oops. You got to make sure you cover yourself on that one. But apparently you guys didn't because you're just too loyal to Kristi, huh? Bren, 70, ultimately left her job this past March after the state paid her $200,000 to withdraw the complaint. Exactly what transpired in the July 27th meeting, the governor's office isn't clear. Noem declined an interview request, and her office declined to answer detailed questions about the meeting. Associated Press is disparaging the governor's daughter in order to attack the governor's politically. No wonder America trusts the media at all-time low, a spokesperson said. Or it could be the fact that your governor is crooked as hell there, Ian Fury. God, man, sounds like a low budget porn name. Ian Fury. Hello there.
Low budget knockoff of Nick Fury. Yeah.
The Revengers. Still, government ethics experts who reviewed the series of events at the AP's request said Noem's decision to include her daughter in the meeting created a conflict of interest regardless of what was discussed. Yeah, you really are not supposed to do bring your daughter to work day when you're chewing out people for not giving your daughter the proper permits that you want her to get. While Peters was applying for the certification, Noem said should have recused herself from discussions in the agency, especially anything that would apply her daughter's application, said Richard Painter, a professor at the University of Minnesota Law School, who is the chief ethics lawyer for the former president, George W. Bush. It's clearly a conflict of interest and an abuse of power to the benefit of the family members. We can get Painter back on the air again. He was good fun. Peters began working as a state registered appraiser, an entry-level job in 2016. She worked under the supervision of a certified appraiser to get the experience necessary to apply for her own residential appraiser certification. It's not an easy hurdle. Applicants must show they can perform appraisals to national standards, putting to use 200 hours of classroom education and months of experience. While trainees make as little as $10 an hour, certified residential appraisers can launch their own business and make more than $50,000 a year. Imagine what someone who's like the governor's daughter could charge to get an appraiser. Oh, imagine that's a lot. I imagine you get probably more than 50. In September 2019, Peters applied to become the certified residential appraiser, but in July 2020, the appraiser certification program moved to deny the license, according to a July 27th letter from Peters' supervisor that was obtained by AP. The certification is denied when applicants' work samples don't meet minimum compliance with national standards, according to the agency's upgrade procedures. Bren, who had directed the appraiser certificate program for 3 decades, told the AP she received the text only on July 26th from her supervisor, telling her to be at the governor's office the next morning, ready to discuss appraiser certification procedures. Well, so let me get this right. Kristi Noem's daughter wasn't smart enough or good enough to be an appraiser. The state held them to the standard. Kristi called an immediate meeting and get her boss and her boss's boss in here so they can apologize to my little princess. And then they gave her the appraiser certificate. Oh, okay. I see how this goes. Hey, you know what's really broken, Ian Fury? Your story. That's right. Why don't you explain what exactly happened, and then we'll stop asking. We're back tomorrow. Native Roots Radio up next. Till tomorrow. See ya.